Hello, and welcome to One-on-One with Robert Doerr. I'm your host, Robert Doerr, and thanks for tuning in today. As president of the American Enterprise Institute, I have the unique privilege of working with America's greatest policy experts. These scholars focus on policy issues in the fields of education, economics, energy, foreign and defense, and so much more. Subscribe to this podcast for exclusive access to in-depth discussions on the most pressing policy issues. Together with my guests, we'll challenge political preconceptions, explore innovative ideas, and create, I hope, a freer and safer world. Joining us today is Dan Cox. Dan is the director of AEI's Survey Center on American Life and a resident scholar at AEI. And I've gotten to know him pretty well over the last few years, and it's been a great joy. He's probably, you know, we haven't done a statistical analysis of this, but he's certainly in the top 10% of most cited and mentioned AEI scholars. And that's because you do all this really interesting work that people are fascinated by. And the great thing about it is it's only a little bit about politics and policy. It's more about life and how people are feeling and what's going on in their relationships. Is that fair that you sometimes go beyond just policy things?
Well, mostly, I would say, yeah. Most of our work is non-political, although we always find ways to tie it back to politics, or someone else does.
Okay. Well, we're going to find a way to tie it back to politics at the end of this conversation, but we're going to start out with the finding that I've been particularly interested in because I have Gen Z children. And here at AEI, with all the young research assistants and other young staffers, we're surrounded by Gen Z people. And it appears from your work that there's a problem in Gen Z between the sexes. Men and women are not seeing the world. Now, they've never always seen the world the same, but they're seeing the world even less the same. Is that true? What's going on between men and women and Gen Z?
So this is part of a larger project I'm working on, trying to understand, you know, what's happening between young men and young women. We're seeing on a host of different attitudes, some divergence on their politics. Young women are becoming increasingly liberal. Young men are not.
And when you say young, we're talking about what age group?
18 to 29 is sort of the typical definition. If we're talking Gen Z, it's 18 to 27. So we kind of use them interchangeably. But this kind of pattern is emerging among people under 30.
Okay.
And you look at like feminist identity, 61% of Gen Z women identify as feminist. It's 43% of Gen Z men.
Well, just stop there. What do you think? What is your survey finding? What does feminist mean? What does it mean to be identified as a feminist? It's a little different than it used to be, seems to me, but is it a little more hostile toward men than it was in the past?
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening, right? That young men are seeing in feminism that it's not simply lifting up women and ensuring parity and equality between the sexes. It's about keeping men down and helping women in the kind of zero-sum environment. So if women are gaining, men are invariably losing. And I think that is coming through in a lot of ways on a lot of these different questions. So you're seeing whether it's abortion and reproductive issues, or feminist identity, there's a growing divergence between young men and young women.
And the divergence, as I read it in your writing, is the young women are viewing men as bad or not mature or sexist or dangerous or problematic. Where does this come from?
Yeah, it's complicated. So there's some work that compared attitudes of young men in the 1970s to young men today, and young men today are more likely to say they've experienced discrimination or harassment, when we know, you know, over the course of 40, 50 years that almost by any measure, incidences of you know, harassment have decreased offline. But what's happening online, I think, is a big part of the story. So there was a recent Pew report that found that the incidence of sexual harassment online had doubled over the last 5 or 6 years, with young women being on the receiving end to most of it.
Well, we'll get to the social media components of this or influences of this, but let's stick with the popular culture for a second. Don't you have some finding that indicates that the sort of Me Too movement and the publicity surrounding very high-profile sexual harassment cases has influenced women's attitude toward men in general in a more negative way than you would expect. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So there's like two sides to the Me Too movement. I think there's a big part to be celebrated is the empowerment of women to talk about their experiences and find solidarity. One really fascinating finding in our poll was that we found that young women are much more likely to sort of share these feelings with other women. So what happens to women in general, they believe, impacts them. So there's this feeling of solidarity, and I think that can be positive. But on the other side, and I think this hasn't been talked about as much, is that this growing view that men are a threat, or that this sort of really negative, pernicious, awful behavior is commonplace in American society, and in particularly in dating life, that this is impacting their expectations about how men behave and what they're like.
So a term that my children occasionally use, especially my daughter, is toxic masculinity. Tell us characteristics of men that are suddenly no longer acceptable.
So I think a lot of the way that boys and young men were socialized in the past, and I'm a father of two boys, and you can sort of even see gender disparities now, was that being assertive and even aggressive in not only like on the athletic field, but in social situations was rewarded, that, you know, you stated your opinion first, you might talk over people. But that now is viewed, whether, you know, we're calling these things mansplaining or manspreading, which is when men sit on like public transit and spread their legs and take up more room, that these things are now really problematic. And I think,
well, let's just stop there for a second, because you'd use two words and you blended them together as if they were the same thing. And then you went to things that really are bad, talking over people, insisting, blah, blah, blah. But assertive is a word. Mm-hmm. Is a characteristic. It's a quality, and aggressive is another one. And so, isn't it possible that what is assertive, in a good way, I'm willing to assert my view and say what I think, without being afraid of repercussions. That's a virtue, but aggressive maybe is not a virtue. Why are these things merging together?
Yeah, I think it depends, right? I wrote this whole piece on the confidence trap that young men face, and it's true in a lot of different contexts, but you particularly see it in dating. So dating culture has shifted pretty dramatically. The sort of financial, economic, political power has shifted a lot between men and women over the past several decades. But there's still an expectation that young men should be confident in this context, that they should be the ones approaching women for the most part. Suggesting, you know, the contours of the dating activities and that kind of thing. And at the same time, they're also criticized for, you know, being overly confident, or, you know, not working sort of more collaboratively and engaging in that way. And I think that's really problematic. It leads a lot of young men to sort of feeling kind of lost and disempowered, and feeling like, well, how do I approach? You're telling me two different things. Kind of sit back, wait my turn, let other people, you know, get their view out. But you're also saying that, you know, I need to stand up for myself and engage, you know, proactively in these other contexts. And
so,
I think it's really, really problematic.
So men get these messages and they lose their confidence. And then this is something that I've observed. And tell me if you're finding this in your data. They then withdraw. They're not in the game. They just say, to heck with this. If you don't like me as I am, then I'm not gonna
participate. I'm not gonna play. You're changing the rules, and in different contexts, the rules are different. They're shifting. It's incredibly problematic. And I think talking about toxic masculinity, one of the big problems with that term is that it is not used to contrast with a positive type of masculinity. Sort of say, here's a good model of masculinity for men to follow, and here's a bad. I would have no problem with that, but it's the only model that we seem to, you know, at least our culture seems to be pushing forward. And so young men looking around sort of say, okay, where are my male role models that I can sort of say, hey, this is how I should be behaving, this is how I should be treating my friends, and how I should be treating women that I'm dating. There's a complete absence of that, and I think that, you know, is really, really challenging.
Okay, so what role did social media play in the creation of this situation?
Yeah, this is an extraordinarily complicated question. I'm finishing Jonathan Haidt's book now, and I'm thoroughly convinced that when you talk about social media use among adolescents, there are significant problems in just the amount of usage. Particularly, it's taking people away from interpersonal interactions. We've seen in our data that the amount of time people spend hanging out with friends has decreased significantly. People are dating less as teenagers, which is a place to build up really important life experiences. And so there's the opportunity costs with social media, right? That I am fully on board and believe Jonathan Haidt got this absolutely right. But there's the content side, which I think his work does not touch on as much. And just it's what people are consuming. We know they're consuming extreme examples of almost everything. And when it comes to consuming things about the views of men and women, there are just example after example of young women, because it's more predominantly featuring content produced by women, negative experiences with men. So whether it's this guy didn't hold the door open for me, or he was rude, he's checking his phone, he was talking about his, you know, whatever that I found offensive. And you're just inundated with these negative stories of male behavior that are then promoted. And these things get hundreds of thousands of millions of hits. And there are actually content creators, influencers, whose sole purpose is to push this kind of content, to create it and push it out to her millions of followers.
So I feel really sad about this. I think you're absolutely right. I think the opportunity cost is a big one. The use of the cell phone to engage in, to have your social interaction, has taken you away from. I mean, you know, it was hard. It was tricky. It was embarrassing. It was nerve-wracking. But you know, the interactions with young people between 13 and 17 are glorious. I mean, they were hilarious. They were the sources of such great learning and discovery. And I see these kids around with these phones, and I realize they're missing out on so much. So I absolutely agree with that. And then on the content, this negative energy. It is always negative. Why does the algorithm push negative?
Because that's what people will stay and watch, right? They want to see the most extreme. They want to see the train wrecks. They want to see, you know, the kind of more modest, contextual analyses of human behavior are not the ones that people will swipe for hours on. And that's what the social medias want. They want your attention, and they want hours of it.
All right, so we started out men and women, and that was bad. Now we're talking about social media, and we haven't mentioned pornography.
Yeah.
What does your studies find?
So not good. I think there's a ton of literature on the pornographic usage, and particularly young men, because it's mostly young men using the young age in which they're getting addicted to this stuff, or it's becoming kind of habitual, part of their lifestyle. The other thing it's sort of changing attitudes around men and women in intimate situations. And we're seeing this new technology around AI and deepfakes is being harnessed for really destructive ends. So we're seeing a rise. There's like a 400% rise in revenge porn that's happening. The usage of deepfakes is often used with putting classmates' images in pornographic context. So and spreading this stuff virally. And so there's a lot of really dark and bleak stuff that's happening. A lot of this stuff is being perpetrated by young men. So this is kind of the other side of it. Women are doing, you know, playing a role, and then men are playing a somewhat different role. It's both creating feelings of resentment and mistrust for a generation that already has pretty low feelings of trust interpersonally, but also in political institutions.
It's so awful. And it's so destructive to people's attitude toward other people. And we don't talk about it much in public policy, but it is one of those things where supporters of freedom, free speech, really have to face up to this is a kind of speech that is destroying the minds of our kids.
And I think part of the problem, so I'm 44, I'm almost 45, so I'm a young Gen Xer. that. So this is a world which I am very unfamiliar with. I've been married over 10 years. And so it's invisible, I think, to a lot of public policymakers and people crafting policy expectations until I unfortunately had to start going on TikTok to start looking at some of this stuff and for research. And it will shock you and startle you. And I think, again, so much of it is occurring out of normal vision for most of us.
So this is a very elementary question, but let's just do this because you're a studier of these things. It's boomers were followed by millennials.
Xers. Gen X.
So boomers, Gen Xers.
Millennials,
Gen Z.
Okay. And my kids are supposedly alpha now. They're...
No, that's
that's coming next.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm a boomer, a very end of the boomers. Okay. All right. So now we've talked about this. It's very depressing. It's very sad. Men and women. I mean, it's the glory of life is your relationships with people that you can form a family with and develop friendships with.
And not to toss a little bit more cold water on all this stuff too, but it's changing attitudes around marriage and family too. We're seeing that young women increasingly believe that men are much more advantaged by being married than women, or being in relationships. That women do most of the work, and there's some truth to the domestic division of labor. That even
my wife would certainly agree with that.
Right?
She, yeah.
When it comes to planning and all that stuff. So again, that's changing. The millennial men are doing much more than their fathers did, but there's some truth underlying this. But it's dramatically changing how young women are thinking about and approaching marriage, and whether they want to get married at all. Our colleague Brad Wilcox has done some great work looking at this stuff, and he's I think some of the work he's suggesting 1 in 3 young people may never marry.
Well, you know, one thing, I think I saw a little clip of this in something on TV or maybe, I mean, I do participate in popular culture, I want everyone to know, but I think it was the clip of a young woman calling out to a young man, marry me. And I thought to myself, maybe that's the solution. Maybe we should have the tradition be certainly open to either man or women asking the other person to marry them. That this, you know, that would be, maybe that would help. I don't know.
I think almost anything, like any sort of positive, constructive change that we could establish as this is sort of the new norm, because we're kind of normless now. Like, it's like, well, you kind of do what feels right to you. And so when people are looking around for models, like, how should I, you know, proceed through life? This is kind of a shrug, and I think it's really difficult.
Boy, oh boy, oh boy. When I was young, and this was a long, long time ago, so I'm 63, and my mother would notice that this was in the 70s, that there was becoming an openness and a more openness, let's just say, about sex and given compared to where we are today, this was little stuff.
Yeah.
She would say, you all are going to ruin it. You're going to ruin sex. It wasn't true for my life, but I'm worried that it's happened now. But then maybe that's a little too personal. Okay, now let's go to politics. How does this play out in Trump, Biden, or Dems, Rs?
So this has been one of the most difficult things that pollsters are trying to wrestle with and figure out is how are young people actually going to vote? We know over the last few decades, Carlin Bowman, our colleague, has tracked this significant advantage that Democrat presidents have and congressional candidates have had with young voters. I think Biden in 2020 had over a 20-point advantage on Trump among young voters. A number of polls are showing Biden and Trump effectively tied, which would be a remarkable about-face in terms of shifting support. Other polls show that Biden still retains some advantage, but I think one thing that we know is happening is that there's a lot less interest this time around among young voters. We saw a spike in 2018 and 2020 in terms of turnout. A lot of that was believed to be fueled by Trump. In 2022, young women are largely pro-choice in response to overturning Roe v. Wade. We also saw an increase there. But in 2024, we know that Biden and Trump are remarkably unpopular among young voters.
But aren't you also finding that the men are tending more conservative and the women tending more progressive?
There has been that shift in voting behavior, or at least there's been a gap of at least 10 points over the last few elections. There's a new survey out by the Harvard's Institute of Politics, and they had a large sample of young people, and they saw a really significant, I think it was like something like a 15-point gap between the preferences of young men and young women. So young men were sort of marginally Democratic. I think Biden was capturing like 54-55%, but young women were like 7 and 10. And so that's fairly
a big gap. Yeah.
Gender gap. And who knows, because Trump's been on the ballot for the Republican Party for the last few elections, whether it's unique to Trump or we're just seeing a sort of larger fundamental shift in terms of support for the GOP. One thing that's really important to note, and it's where some folks have pushed back against some of the stuff that I've written, and I've sort of said there's definitely some nuance here, is that when it comes to issue positions, young men are still more to the left than older men on, like, gay marriage, on views of you know, wanting more active government. But I think what's happening is that the Republican Party is, and conservatives in general, are more actively talking about the welfare of men, and particularly young men, whereas the Democratic Party and folks on the left are more strongly advocating kind of exclusively for young women. In fact, if you go on the Democratic Party's website, they mention 16 different constituencies or groups that they're advocating for, they're fighting for. Veterans, women, African-Americans, Latinos, rural people, urban people. Can you guess what group was omitted? Men. There's no mention of men there, which I find kind of astounding. But I think it's kind of emblematic of the approach that the more gendered approach that the parties are taking.
And so the gender gap between old and young is still there. The young are more likely to be progressive or supporting Dems, but not as much as they were before. That's the generational gap.
Mm-hmm.
And the gap between men and women, which was always there, always was this thing where ours did better with women, with men than these.
Since at least the 80s.
And now is it getting, you're saying it may be getting worse, okay, maybe more dramatic.
I think the gender gap could overall increase, but also among young people. If you just look at you know, the way Trump's run his campaigns and the policies that, you know, he's promoted, and I think he's trying to find a way to walk this fine line on abortion, which, you know, there's a significant gender gap on views of abortion. Young in 2022, it was the most important issue for young women. So he's recognizing that as a potential challenge and trying to find a way to talk about it.
Well, we'll see how this all works out as the campaign progresses. Maybe we'll get you back to talk about when we get closer to election time. I'd love that. But for now, listeners, Dan Cox, the director of AEI's Survey Center on American Life and a resident scholar here with us. We're very proud to have him. And I do urge all of you to read his writing because he's often way ahead of everybody else. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Robert.